here's the order of bills that we'll do. We'll do our work sessions first, and then we will hear 3183, and then we'll hear 2372, and hope to be done by 2:30. Open a... Is Senator Morse? He's on his way.
One sec. Which one are we going to do first?
I'd like to do Frank's bills. Open a work session on SJR 2, which we heard a couple of days ago. Senator Morse, do you want to come back up and just walk us through the amendments that you're asking for and the ones you're not asking for?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, start with SJR 2-2 or SB 5-1. It has to do with on page 2, with the language, which the original draft left some question with respect to the interpretation of how the 10% applied. In the language as it now reads, if the amount of the reserve fund exceeds 10% of the amount of the general fund budget approved at the regular session of the Legislative Assembly for that biennium, the, and then continues to make that change, Mr. Chairman. And that would also be the same change that would occur in SJR 2-3.
So just for clarity,
excuse me.
Go ahead. For clarity, so you're asking for the dash threes on SJR 2.
SJR 2, asking for the dash three amendments, and the dash one amendments on SB 5. Also asking for dash three amendments on SB 5, which are of a technical nature, recommendations by the State Treasurer's Office. I would ask for adoption of those and SJR 2-5 amendments.
Okay. So the dash threes on SB 5, which are the technical treasurer amendments. Which we'll do next. What's the last three? Is that five?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
My vote is required in the Human Services Ways and Means to vote a bill out. This is an embarrassing moment.
I think we're good.
Can I run down and at least stick my head in the door and I'll run right back?
Please.
Okay, thank you.
So I'll let Mr. Warner just reacquaint us with all the dash amendments we have before us just on SJR 2 for now.
Okay. Mr. Chair, there are three amendments on SJR 2, and they're all, they replace one another, not to be summed together. Senator Morse referred to the 2-3, and what that does is correct language around the budget, the general fund budget, makes reference to general fund specifically rather than just budget, and it makes it clear that it's 10% of the budget rather than the budget plus 10%. So that's the SJR-3s. 2-3s. The dash SJR-4 makes those same changes, so it would replace the dash threes, makes those same language changes, but it raises the reserve fund cap on page 2, line 6, is the only difference.
So this is Senator Burdick's.
This is Senator Burdick's, and it raises that to 25%, but it does make the same language adjustment, so it would be a replacement for the dash 2s. For the dash threes. And then finally, the last amendment that Senator Morse referred to, the dash fives, they're also standalone amendments because they do correct the language on the general fund budget. They maintain the 10% as the cap, but then they put in on page 2, line 6 there, they put in a new section. And this is consistent with the Treasury amendments that are in the dash 3 of Senate Bill 5. So there's a reference to that particular fund is managed by the Treasurer. So that's the only difference is the lines 6, 7, and 8 on page 2 were added to the dash to the SJR dash 3s.
Thank you.
On the SBs, these would the dash ones are consistent with the SJR dash threes. They make the wording change in the general fund budget and the 10%. The SB dash twos are consistent with the SJR dash four. And what they do is make that same language change and then refer to the 25% instead of the 10%. And then the dash threes refer to the budget. They adds a new section there. You can see the section 6. And that's the reference to the various accounts that are managed by the Treasury. And then it adds the general fund operating reserve into those accounts. And gives the same general guidelines to the Treasurer to manage those accounts. So this would be in addition to either the dash ones or dash twos. It's not a replacement for them.
Thank you. So my understanding would be you would do, they're exclusive of each other. So on the SJR, you would do the threes, the fours, or the fives.
On the SJRs, yes, you would do either. Or, mm-hmm. There would be no ands there. So they're standalone choices, the 2, 3, or the 4.
Right.
If you were to adopt the 4s, then you would need to make the adjustment on the Treasury language.
Okay.
That's because that's not in the dash 4s.
Thank you.
My apologies again for... A long ways down that hallway. So
we're in work session. We're up to speed. What I heard you, Senator Morse, was that you're requesting dash fives on SJR 2 and then the dash threes on SB 5.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And the dash ones.
And the dash ones. On 5, right.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Are you ready for a motion?
I am, committee, or I am.
And we're in work session on SJR 2.
Correct.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 5 amendments to SJR 2.
Senator Ringo has moved the dash 5 amendments to SJR 2. Discussion. Clerk?
Dash 5.
Aye.
Ringo?
Aye.
Aye.
Perry Allen?
No.
Eckert?
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I move SJR 2 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved SJR 2 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Chair, please call.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I just want to thank Senator Morse and Senator Burdick again for the good work on this.
you have worked very hard, I know, to get this to this point, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I just say that this is an issue that's important, I think, for us to have a debate discussion on the Senate floor, and I look forward to it. This, again, is an opportunity, potentially an opportunity for the voters to have a look at whether or not they want us to create a budget stabilization fund. And so look forward to the discussion and debate on the Senate floor.
Tara, please call the roll.
Ms. Corcoran?
Aye.
Aye.
Ringo?
Aye.
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 Darielle?
No.
Okay.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Morse, would you like to carry?
It says Senator Perriola carry it.
I'll carry it.
No, Mr. Chairman, that would not be acceptable to me.
He's good. He's very good.
Yeah. He is good.
I would be delighted to. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
We're going to get your other bill done here. Open a work session on Senate Bill 5.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I move the dash 1 and dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 5.
Yeah. So Senator Ringo has moved the dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 5. Discussion on the dash 1s. Tara, please.
Ms. Corcoran?
Aye.
Ringo?
Aye.
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 Allen?
No.
Okay.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Ringo.
Let's try to move the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 5.
Senator Ringo has moved the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 5. Discussion. Tara, please.
Ms. Corcoran?
Aye.
Ringo?
Aye.
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 Allen?
No.
Okay.
Aye. Motion carries.
On the contrary,
Senator Ringo.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 5 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved Senate Bill 5 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Tara, you're earning your money today.
Senator Clarkin?
Aye.
Ringo?
Aye.
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 Allen?
No.
Okay.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Morse will carry the bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move that one. We're going to move out here.
We are not going to do a work session on House Bill 2043, so we will move.
We're not going to?
We are not. So we will move and open a public hearing on House Bill 3183.
Chairman Deckard and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. So with House Bill 3183, what this bill is it changes the corporate apportionment formula from 80%, and that is something that is beginning in May of 2003, where it already has begun. And then it's going to increase that from 80% to 90%, and then it'll be 5% payroll and 5% property factors beginning May 1st of 2005. Then it increases the sales factor of the corporate apportionment formula to 100% sales beginning May 1st, 2007. And it states that the property factor does not apply to the apportionment of business income after May 1st, 2007, and is repealed on January 2nd of 2012. It also outlines the conditions in which the payroll factor is used in determining the state taxes for ordinary businesses. So you do not have any amendments, but basically the background for this bill is that all states tax corporate income using an apportionment formula to determine how much of that multi-state corporate income is subject to tax in that state. And Oregon, like most states, has a three-factor corporate apportionment formula, the sales, the payroll, and property. And as we had during orientation and stuff, we had a list of the different states and their apportionment formulas. But as of 2001, of the 47 states with corporate income taxes, 14 states, or 30%, use an equally weighted apportionment formula between all those three factors. 25 states, or 53%, use a double-weighted sales apportionment formula. And 4 states, or 8.5%, use a 100% sales apportionment formula. And 4 states also use an apportionment formula with sales factors between the 50% and 90%, which is what Oregon is now falling into. Some states also use a different apportionment formula for different corporate sectors in their states. So basically, in 2001, you had House Bill 2281 that was enacted, which changed our corporate apportionment formula in Oregon, and it increased the sales factor from 50% to 80% and reduced those payroll factors from 25% to 10% for fiscal years beginning May of 2003. Now, basically, with changing that corporate formula, it increases the tax liability for some corporations and reduces it for others. And so what I've given you is basically a summary sheet there, which goes through which corporations have a reduction in the apportionment formula versus which corporations have an increase in that apportionment formula, so you can get a sense of when you do go to 100% sales, what's the impact. This was done from last session's bill. It's based on the 1998 tax returns, but at least gives you an understanding both distributional-wise as well as by the different industry sectors. And what you can see from that is that the corporate returns by federal taxable income, the corporations with a reduction in their taxes from going to 100% sales apportionment formula would be primarily from the higher income corporations with taxable income greater than $500 million. And there's roughly 47 corporations that are in that, and they would make up more than 75% of that reduction in corporate apportionment formula tax. And then what you see is that for the corporations that have an increase in an apportionment formula, there's roughly the reduction was $85 million as far as the total dollar amount based on 1998 returns. And the increase was $44.6 million as far as the increase from the change in the apportionment formula. And there, with the increase, it's would result in like 50, but the majority of it would be like $14 million would be for those corporations with income above $1 billion, and that would be 59 corporations. So what you see, basically, when you look at the distributional breakdown, is there's more corporations that have an increase in their apportionment formula from going to 100% sales factor, but it's the larger corporations that are actually the ones that are going to be benefiting from the reduction. So that's why you do have a negative result then overall when you're moving to a larger sales factor. So basically with the revenue impact statement here, increasing the sales factor in the corporate apportionment formula to 90% and then eventually to 100% will reduce state general fund revenue for fiscal years beginning May of 2005. And this reduction is $10.9 million in the 2005-07 biennium and $23.3 million in the 2007-09 biennium. Now this is corporate revenues have fallen significantly since last session when we had our other bill changing the corporate apportionment formula. So that's why this revenue impact is significantly lower than what we saw from the revenue impact from last session's bill of going from 50% to 80%. But basically, again, the ones that the change in the corporate apportionment formula is really designed to stimulate investment in property in the state. The corporations, as you can see from the distributional breakdown by industry, are corporations with a lot of property, and the major manufacturers are the ones who are going to be ones who would gain the most from this change in the 100% sales. And then the increase in corporate taxes, the ones who would see an increase would be like wholesale trade corporations.
Thank you. So have we learned anything? It's just too premature from the implementation in early May.
Chairman Deckard, that's correct. Yeah, we just started moving from 50% to 80%, so we don't have any new data as far as what kind. And I guess I didn't talk right here, too. I've given you static numbers and feedback on the revenue impact. I gave you $10.9 million in 05, 07 by AIM is including some feedback effects, and the feedback effects are really looking at when you have a change in the apportionment formula, you're going to be stimulating some corporations to buy additional equipment, which will then stimulate additional economic development in the state. So that has been incorporated through our OTM model to take – that's what the feedback effects there are. But I will say that with a change like the corporate apportionment formula, it's not – again, when you have this split where some corporations are benefiting, some corporations are not, then the feedback effects are not as large. You see it in terms of jobs in particular with OTM. The results indicate that you've got a netting going on because some corporations are benefiting, so they will be increasing jobs, but then other corporations are not benefiting, so they will not be increasing employment. So it's a netting effect, and so you can see that this is not having the same stimulus effect in terms of jobs as some of the other measures that have been considered.
Okay, thank you. Paul Phillips, do you have a panel that you want to, or Representative Scott, would you like to introduce your bill? And Mr. Meter, if you're representing Representative Nelson, if you want to come up if she's not able to join us. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Chair Deckard, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wayne Scott, State Representative for House District 39. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3183. As you know, House Bill 3183 increases the sales factor of the corporate apportionment formula to 90% beginning in 2005 and further increasing to 100% in 2007. This measure will reduce and ultimately remove the disincentive for businesses to locate and expand in Oregon. It will make Oregon an attractive location for corporate headquarters and will undoubtedly result in the creation of new jobs, although, as the report said, may be small. Oregonians desperately need that. As written, House Bill 3183 has no real revenue impact on the 2003-05 biennium. Although it will not cost the state anything during 03-05, passing 3183 today will send a very strong message to Oregon businesses and those businesses considering to move to Oregon. It will tell them that we want business to thrive in Oregon, not that we want to punish them for their success, but to welcome them to come here. I encourage you to join our House colleagues in passing House Bill 3183. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, I'm going to attempt to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Meter.
Thank you. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Matt Metter. I work for Representative Donna Nelson. And I have a brief statement on her behalf in support of House Bill 3183 today. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I thank you on behalf of Representative Nelson for your consideration today of House Bill 3183. A successful business base translates to a robust economy. Now, more than ever, it is critical that we bolster our business base as we toil to rebuild our economy. Simply put, House Bill 3183 is good for business in Oregon. The state's current business tax structure gives Oregon no edge as we compete to recruit companies to establish corporate headquarters and manufacturing facilities in Oregon. Indeed, Oregon's business base has shrunk in recent years as we continue to discourage members of our business community from reinvesting or expanding within this state. House Bill 3183 affirms Oregon's commitment to the economic well-being of our business community by shifting a portion of their tax burden to out-of-state corporations. The passage of this bill will demonstrate our desire that Oregon companies continue to invest and expand in Oregon. In times of economic turmoil, it is important that we show our appreciation of and confidence in those companies that are our very own. There is no magic solution to Oregon's current financial situation. As we struggle to restore our economy to a state of good health and fiscal responsibility, it is critical that we avoid solutions that seek short-term revenue at the expense of long-term economic development. It is for the economic health of our beloved Oregon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that, on behalf of Representative Nelson, I urge you to support House Bill 3183. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate your time. Mr. Amos, Mr. Logan, Mr. Modesky? Modesky.
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, my name is Eric Amos. I'm here from Columbia Sportswear. I'm joined on my left by Mark Modesky from Tektronix and Al Logan from Nike. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. In summary, Columbia Sportswear is in strong support of House Bill 3183 for two primary reasons. The first one is we feel it's bad public policy to discourage companies from investing in Oregon citizens by hiring them and from an Oregon infrastructure by building distribution centers, by building headquarters, and by building manufacturing facilities. The second reason is that House Bill 3183 does an excellent job of stabilizing our state tax revenues from corporations because the corporate income would not be based almost exclusively on Oregon-based businesses, but would spread it on a nationwide level to other out-of-state corporations as well. I want to give you a little bit of personal experience that Columbia Sportswear has had with our apportionment structure. In the last several years, we've more than doubled the size of our distribution center out at Rivergate. We also purchased a new headquarters in Washington County, and we've grown considerably as a company, hiring a lot of people. As a direct result of these investments, our Oregon tax liability is roughly two times what it would have been had we chose to invest in a state with a single sales factor or just across the river in Vancouver. So we are essentially being penalized for two things. One, for creating and hiring people in the state of Oregon. And two, for building structures within the state of Oregon. So you're looking at me and saying, why did you expand in Oregon then? It's an excellent question, and it was certainly not because of advice from our tax department. The first reason is we're a homegrown company. Gert, her son Tim, and most of the management is from Oregon, and they've lived in Oregon their entire lives. Second, it's very difficult and costly to move a company. So you got to take a lot of things into consideration, and you don't want to lose half your employment staff by moving. However, I can assure you that other companies within Oregon and out of Oregon don't share our allegiance to this state, particularly in today's climate where there's a lot of mergers and acquisitions activity. Anytime there's a merger or an acquisition, to some degree, there's a little flexibility to decide where you're going to locate that structure. So in our case, one of the reasons for not moving was because of the cost of uprooting a business. However, when you're dealing with a merger or an acquisition, that's not always a consideration. I think you need to look to the last 10 to 20 years in the state of Oregon to really get a good picture for the number of companies, large, important companies, that have left Oregon. Now, I'm not saying it's because of the Oregon apportionment factor exclusively, but I've got to believe it was one of the reasons. In conclusion, I just want to reiterate our support for House Bill 3183. We believe it does encourage in-state economic development, and we also believe that it stabilizes state tax revenues from corporations because it would be based on a national economy instead of just the Oregon economy. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Ringo.
Thanks for coming this afternoon. I am curious about exactly what is it about Washington's tax structure that would have made it more favorable for you to locate in Vancouver. You know, there's a study that people around here often refer to, a Utah study, that says that Oregon has the lowest business tax burden of the 11 western states, one of the lowest business tax burdens in the country. And I just wondered if you could reconcile that with why it might have been more favorable for you to locate in Vancouver.
Well, Washington, I'm sorry, Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, Washington has a very convoluted tax structure, to say the least. They do not have an income tax. They have what's called a business and occupation tax, which would be extraordinarily beneficial to our company. I would have to probably break out my spreadsheet and abacus to fully explain the reasons for that, but suffice to say that their tax structure is fundamentally different from ours, which would result in benefits to our company in particular.
I see. Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, obviously every company has different financial considerations, but it sounds like you're saying it's something specific to Columbia Sportswear that would have made it more advantageous to go to Vancouver, but you can't say that about other businesses or businesses in general.
I would hesitate to say that about other businesses in general, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Just following up on that, could you say that the class, similar to Columbia, of others who either manufacture here in Oregon would find themselves, is that a fair statement, find themselves at least in a similar type position?
Senator Deckert, for wholesale distribution companies, I would say that's probably a fair statement in terms of where to locate a distribution center or some other facility such as that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd hate to speculate too much deeper on that.
I know, it's true. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senators, for the record, my name is Mark Mojeski, and I'm the tax director for Tektronix, Inc., an Oregon-based company founded in 1946. I believe all of you have a copy of my letter dated March 19th in support of HB 3183, and so I won't bore you by reading that letter into the record, but I'd like to boil it down to a couple of points and then simply conclude. From Tektronix's perspective, HB 3183 should be looked at as a tool that will encourage business formation and investment in Oregon. Companies that predominantly sell into Oregon but do not have factories here or employ workers here will consider broadening their operations in Oregon if HB 3183 is enacted. This is because the bill will eventually eliminate the current income tax burden of including both the property factor and the payroll factor in the calculation of Oregon taxable income. Importantly, Oregon will be the first state on the West Coast to use a single-weighted sales factor, thus giving Oregon an edge in any relocation decision. Finally, HB 3183 is not a cure-all for the stuttering Oregon economy that we have today, but if it's enacted into law, the economic benefits resulting to the state will most likely be felt gradually over time. However, HB 3183 will send a strong message to the business community that Oregon is open for business. It will give corporate decision makers a measurable financial reason to relocate or expand operations in Oregon, thus creating additional jobs and a more stable tax base. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Ringo.
Thanks for testifying. Not directly on the bill, but I guess I'd like your opinion as to whether you think that Oregon's tax structure is unfriendly to business.
The tax structure, the corporate income tax structure, in our opinion, is hurtful to the large companies who have predominantly used their capital in business operations for reinvesting in Oregon. For instance, Tektronix. Roughly 75% of our production is here. Our worldwide production is here in Oregon. 55% of our headcount is here in Oregon. 80% or more of our property, the investment in the company over the past 50-plus years is here in Oregon. We have a very significant apportionment factor under the current legislative regime, and quite frankly, we feel that burden is excessive given what other states are attempting to do by moving to a single sales factor regime.
Thank you.
How significant was HES? I know we've just got a brief history with this, just this last month, the 80%. do you have any data would be tough, but how significant has that been? And I guess what I'd tag on with that question is, should we, in reviewing this bill, let that go for a year or two, and then when we come back in 05, make the decision, implement 100%. This bill just contemplates pushing it off to 05.
Right. Tektronix, we have not even 1 month of closed data here at our disposal to sort of do a rough and dirty calculation on the back of a napkin. Our apportionment factor will be lower. But you have to remember that, you know, you're apportioning Oregon taxable income. And Tektronix, you know, we're a technology company. Our business moves in cycles. Right now we're in a down cycle. Our income is not as high as it would be in an upturn. So the impact of it cannot be measured at this time. It's helpful that we've moved in this direction. We can take the additional dollars and we can funnel it back into R&D and producing equipment here in Oregon. In terms of the actual magnitude of the of scoring it at this point, I'm afraid I can't do it at this juncture.
Do you think it would be reasonable for a policymaker, one of us, to say we'd like to wait a year or two and really look at how this, you know, a year from now we'll know a lot more, and then make a decision?
I don't know how much more you're going to really know. I didn't have a chance to see what the legislative revenue staff produced, but again, the data was from 1998. If we wait a year, will the data be from 1999 or 2000? I just don't think you're going to have a good picture based on the data. We're here, of course, to say, you know, move forward. Now's the opportunity. We've taken the big bite of the apple last session. Let's sort of finish the job now.
Thank you. Senator Starr.
Thank you. And I'm kind of following up on that same line of questioning. Provided that this legislature were to act and pass this bill and move it forward and the governor to sign it and it become law, clearly there's a phase-in period. For your particular company, when you forecast down the road as far as where you're going to make investments and where you're going to spend money, you don't make that decision today and spend the money tomorrow. That's my assumption. I assume you make the decision today, but it takes a period of time for you to make those investments, where you're going to expand, where you're going to grow. It seems to me that we passed this bill, and it would coincide with a decision a company makes today about expanding into the future, in that those expansions and the implementation of this bill would coincide, and you would receive the benefits of this. Is that?
Well, you're right. The tough decisions as to where to expand and how are made typically, you know, 12, 18, 24 months ahead of the actual, I'll call ramp up of the manufacturing process. So it would be very nice for us to go back to our bosses and say, we have this bill. Continue to make your investment here in Oregon. You can count on Oregon being a friendly place for business.
Thank you.
Greetings.
Chairman Deckert, committee members. My name is Al Logan. I'm the state and local tax manager at Nike, and I'm here today to ask for your support, House Bill 3183. I agree with what's been said ahead of me, and that's going to make this very short, because what I want to get to actually is the question that you've asked, Senator Deckert, on what has going from 50% to 80% done. Well, I can't answer that specifically. What we do have data on is when Oregon used to be an equal-weighted apportionment factor state and went to the double-weighted. And we passed this bill in 89. It was effective for 1991. And we do have data, 91 to the mid-90s, on what happened when we made this change. First off, the tax on multi-state tax returns, or multi-state tax return filers, multi-state companies, went up 84% for the period of 1991 to 1994, while the actual number of filers only went up 12%. So rather than a revenue shortfall or a tax cut to companies, the opposite actually occurred. Taxes went up while the filers themselves went up at a much less or much slower rate. The other important item to note there is that from 1991 to 1996, corporate tax receipts to the state of Oregon grew 131% just over that five-year period, while the Oregon gross state product grew only 52.6%. So corporate receipts grew at over two times the rate that the Oregon economy was growing. And what that would suggest is that by more heavily weighting the sales factor, we encourage businesses to invest in this state and to put their property and their payroll here. I think I'd like to conclude with just one thought, and that is that I think some of the argument against this bill is that it really is nothing more than a tax break to corporations, and I think I would disagree with that. And I would say that this is actually a win-win opportunity for this state. What this does is it provides an incentive to multi-state taxpayers, multi-state businesses in this state, by taking away the detriment that they incur by putting property and payroll into this state. So we encourage those companies to expand here. The other thing that is, the other win in this is that this is a win for the state of Oregon because this has the potential to create jobs and economic activity, and that, I think, is where we think the state can generate revenue and take care of these budget issues that we face today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have one question, just kind of leaning, and this is more of a general question, leaning on your tax experience and expertise that you have in your companies. If you were at a convention, a national convention of your peers, and we say we enact this bill and so we get to 100%, or we have a date certain which we're at 100%, but at that point would you say, if one of your peers asked you, how's Oregon in terms of taxing Nike or Columbia or Tektronix, would you be able to say, we are a favorable state, or we're middle of the road, and here's the changes that they might contemplate to get into that favorable?
I think we could. Oh, excuse me, Chairman Deckard. I think we could easily say it was tax favorable if we did that. If this actual apportionment formula benefits those states that go to it first, it puts them in the lead and makes them the attractive state for business. All you can do if you wait is follow and make yourself equal to every state that has enacted it. Mm-hmm. So, yes, but going to any convention and somebody asking, is it tax friendly? Certainly. And in Nike's case, I might point out, and this is actually sort of a answer to your question, Senator Ringo, in that, you know, what does it mean to us? Well, when you compare us with other states, we pay more tax to Oregon than any other state in the country. Any other state in this country. And one of the reasons is simply because we have headquarters here. We have people and property here. If you just look at our sales activity across the state, it's relatively even. But we pay a huge amount of money here simply because we've invested in this community. And that's the thing that we're trying to take care of here, is saying that if we want to create jobs here and help support this community, we should be penalized for that by having these jobs and creating them.
I think, Chair Deckard, I'd like to address that question as well. The convention you speak of literally happens once a week in terms of ourselves and our peers across the country at other major corporations get notifications from various services that keep us updated on exactly what each state is doing. We then are invited to planning sessions with our counterparts and operations to determine where to locate business. And part of the analysis is, what is our tax bill going to be if we locate in the state? So to say passage of the bill today will affect a decision we're making 2 years from now is correct, because that will be weighted into it. It would never stop at the question of, is Oregon tax friendly? You would actually drill down into the details and figure out exactly what's going to happen to us if we move to Oregon versus California mm-hmm. or versus Washington. So it's what you speak of does truly happen.
Mm-hmm. But it passes the nod test of, if you're at that convention, yes, mm-hmm. they did this, I would consider this a tax-friendly
state. Yeah, I'd just like to reiterate that it would be a very strong endorsement to Oregon, to the tax community, as I testified Some of our brethren, though, will not be happy, and that includes some tax directors at some companies that use Oregon as only a marketing state. They don't have people here. They don't have factories here. And, of course, the comeback at those conventions would be, hey, join us here. Build a factory here. Employ some people here. Get a regional headquarters here. We've now established ourselves on the West Coast as being a leader in terms of tax policy.
Okay, Senator Starr. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for all of you can answer. How would this compare to the repeal of the unitary tax in the early 80s as an indication that Oregon is open for business? Is that too strong of a comparison if we're talking about wanting to attract jobs and economic activity and development in the state?
Why? Let's defer to the senior member of the panel here.
Chairman Deckard, Senator Starr, I'm not sure about that. I'd have a tough time sort of weighing it against that. Because I don't have those numbers readily available. Certainly going from 80% to 100% probably doesn't have as much impact as the unitary issue, I would say. So it's probably less of an impact issue than that was then. If we were still equal weighted going to 100%, then obviously that would have quite a bit more weight.
Right. Same. Good.
Yeah. Senator Ringo.
I'm just curious, and perhaps somebody else on the committee can answer, but what is the thinking as far as phasing it in to 100% so that we get there in 07 as opposed to faster? Does it have to be phased in? Or
I think it's just a recognition of the economic realities that we're in as a state right now.
That the fiscal burden would be too great if we went to it immediately.
I would ask
somebody else, I'm sure.
I wouldn't say it's too great, but I think we want to be sensitive to the fact that we have a problem today. And we don't want this. We want to contribute to the solutions, not to the problem of our budget issues. So by phasing this in and by pushing it out, we're saying we can plan now for the future without having any impact, detrimental impact on today's problem.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Ringo.
One thing you haven't discussed is Oregon's corporate tax rate. If that were an issue, one response might be to go to the singles factor immediately and perhaps bump the rate up just a little bit to offset the fiscal hit to the state. Any reaction to that?
Sure, Dr. Senator Ringo. The problem with doing that is you would impact every single business within Oregon, small and large, by increasing the corporate tax rate. Not only multi-state businesses, but in-state businesses as well would have to essentially supplement this. So that, although it is a consideration, it's not our first choice.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Nesbitt, Ms. Wimmer Whalen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, here in opposition to the bill. And we've spent some amount of time in prior hearings on the general subject of business tax effort, the decline in business tax effort, and whether we're a business-friendly state when it comes to taxes. I think the record shows when we have the lowest business tax share and the lowest business tax rates of all 11 Western states, that our tax system ought to be an inducement to locate here. That said, you heard a presentation just now from the winners. Those would be the winners under this bill. You didn't hear from the losers. With twice as many employers likely to pay more taxes under this change in the apportionment formula, I think it's incumbent to take a careful look at where the impacts will be in our economy in terms of jobs gained and jobs lost if certain employers are paying more taxes. You know, it was exactly this proposal, the sales factor proposal, which gave rise to your Oregon tax incidence model. Way back in 99, this proposal came up for single sales factor. There was debate back and forth. In fact, the bill was passed and the governor vetoed it in that session, which gave rise to the whole discussion of who ultimately pays taxes and what, how can we really get a better handle on the ultimate impact in terms of jobs and other factors when we make changes in the tax system. So you budgeted $300,000. I think you spent something less than that. Maybe it's $200,000, but a sizable investment of money and resources went into producing the Oregon tax incidence model. That model was used to assess the impacts of this particular bill now before you. And I didn't see the data handed out today, but I saw data from LRO using the Oregon tax incidence model for this bill on the, when it was looked at on the House side, and it shows a projection of 21 jobs created in the course of implementation by a point in time 5 years from now, which is how OTIM projects, it looks out 5 years. That averages out to a cost in terms of the revenue loss here of over $300,000 per job. I don't think this bill stands up to scrutiny when you look at its impact on jobs and you look at its impact on our economy. And for all the effort that you put into the Oregon tax incidence model, we submit you should be paying careful attention to its findings. Secondly, obviously it will create an inequity with a business doing most of its sales in Oregon. Think of a mom-and-pop retailer. Think of wholesalers, as you already heard, who do a predominant, if not exclusively, all of their businesses within the borders of Oregon. Thirdly, take a careful look at the revenue impact, even if it's delayed. $11.7 million is not insignificant. $14.6 million, by the way, buys a full day of school in Oregon for all 550,000 K-12 school kids. You have to factor that into the equation as well. We're getting a little tired about the debate. We'd just as soon see, maybe the way to call the question is this. Let's do away with all the corporate tax breaks in our tax code, all of them, and say instead we'll provide a $1,000 tax credit for every job created and sustained in Oregon. That would be actually cheaper to do than what we're doing now in the patchwork of our tax system, and it would more definitely equate to supporting good jobs. I submit this is not a jobs bill for workers. It's a profits bill for large corporations, many of whom, including two of the three represented in the panel preceding me, do most of their manufacturing offshore. We don't think we can afford this change. We don't think it's good for Oregon. We don't think it's good for workers, and we don't think it's a net cost-effective way to produce more jobs in our economy.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Education Association. It's 44,000 members, and we too here are here to oppose the bill because we feel that it's further modifying the business apportionment formula beyond the concessions made to its proponents last session as part of compromise legislation. That seems to us to be a violation of the deal. Our opposition to the bill, both last session and now, is also based on the eventual revenue reduction that this change will cause, as well as those issues argued by my colleague. We believe that the proponents' lack of data to prove the contention that the single sales factor will bring economic stimulus is an issue that you should consider. Indeed, the proponents who are already located in this state are the ones asking for this break for themselves, even though they have just admitted to you that tax policy was not determinative in their location decisions for their companies. So I think common sense dictates that you look carefully at who's asking for this and why. Oregon sales-based businesses, as you've also just heard, will pay a tax increase under this bill. That's another point that I think you shouldn't lose sight of. And that will cost jobs, I think, arguably. A very small number of corporations will enjoy the majority of the tax cut that the change in this tax policy would therefore result in, and that begs a fairness question. I would remind the committee that time and time again, corporate leaders have reported that a high-quality education system is the leading factor in corporate relocation and expansion decisions. Contrary to the remarks made earlier, it's not tax policy, it's education. If this legislature were to actually resume funding public education adequately, your return on investment would be a much more sure bet than passage of this bill. from our perspective at Ground Zero in the revenue crisis that we are currently experiencing, we marvel that this bill could even be considered, whether phased in or enacted outright, given the ultimate net revenue loss to the state down the road. A better job creation and economic recovery strategy would be to expand those tax breaks that are accountability-based, such as the strategic investment tax breaks instead. We respectfully urge the committee not to move the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I have just one question, and these are all, it's hard to measure, you know, relocation decisions, but Oregon, we know, has lost I think we're down to one Fortune 500 headquarters here in Oregon, and you can never measure, I guess, what would cause someone to leave, or, I mean, although you can, I think OTIM does help in terms of what is the stimulator. Would you share the concern that, I mean, I asked about if you're at a convention, and I know that is not a quantifiable number, but by Oregon taking steps that would at least allow the tax manager at three of our companies to say yes, on the tax issue, Oregon has created a friendly environment, a welcoming environment, one that we'd like to expand. Do you see the benefit at all in, I guess, that equation?
Mr. Chair, I think anybody who's been out of state at a conference or convention in the last few months has been asked first, have you fixed your schools yet? Mm-hmm. And I think if we don't do that, if we don't provide an adequate level of funding for basic services, especially education, we're not going to attract corporations and businesses here.
Mr. Chair, I'd also echo that and remind you that I think it was either in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, I could find out and provide this to the committee if you'd like. About a year ago, there was a survey done by an independent organization on what the top 10 reasons were for relocation of corporations by the CEOs of the top 100 companies, and not one of the top 10 included tax policy, favorable tax policy, but education was on the list.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if they would be independent of each other. I know that there is a link, but I don't know if they'd be independent of each other.
I would also argue that if we are the lowest of 11 Western states, we are a tax-friendly climate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Craven, Mr. Nelson, Mr. Copenhagen.
Chairman Deckert, committee members, I guess I'll go first. I'm Kirk Copenhagen, Director of Public Affairs for Longview Fiber Company, and I'm commenting with concerns about this single sales factor 3183 bill, primarily because it would cost our company approximately $500,000 annually, and over approximately 10 years when fully implemented, the cost would run up to $5 or $6 million. Longview Fiber has been around Oregon. We've been part of the economy here for over 40 years when we first started acquiring timberlands. Today we own and manage for sustained yield about a third of a million acres of timber in six tree farms in northwest Oregon and Columbia Gorge. Primarily we're just harvesting, growing the timber and selling logs to Oregon sawmills. The majority of that goes to those mills. That has helped sustain employment in our industry for a number of years. We actually provide indirect employment, and that's where we get caught in this particular bill. The indirect employment of 65 independent logging and forestry contractors, many of these folks have been with us for decades. We consider them our own employees. That's also contributed to the state economy. And annually we buy approximately $35 million worth of wood chips from these sawmills. A lot of those chips are made as a residual of lumber from the logs that we provide them. We pay market prices and then transport them up to Longview where we have a large paper mill and use them for paper making. Also, we've provided enhanced public benefits. Our biologists and our foresters, large dollar investments in the Oregon Salmon Plan. We've been one of the leaders in that salmon plan. And in addition to stream restoration and salmon recovery, in that project, we have our own voluntary projects on many streams in Oregon, West Fork Hood River, Scapoose River, various branches of Eagle Creek, and on and on. So we're asking the committee to consider exempting Longview Fiber from this bill based on our contributions through the years. As I say, it's been three or four decades. And we would, based on what I just said, our contributions to the state, its workforce, and enhanced public benefits. We've had a, Senator Corcoran gave us authorization to have an amendment drawn up, very tight, I might add, that would limit it to primarily our company. And that's attached. I think each one of you have a copy there. It's the boldface on the front page, and the qualifier or threshold is 300,000 acres. And there's only four companies in that category, and the other three have shown no interest in 2001, nor has it shown any interest in the legislation introduced this session. So basically, it's limited to our company. And so we ask the committee, we very much appreciate your considering here of including the amendment and improving it, approving it, and I'm open for questions. That's all my comments.
Thank you, Kurt. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel, representing the Oregon Metals Industry Council, as well as Les Schwab Tire. Both the Oregon Metals Industry Council and Les Schwab Tire support House Bill 3183. I think Senator Starr raised a good point in terms of, and it's very important, especially to the Metals Industry Council and to Les Schwab, as we look forward at coming out of the economy, we need tools in order to make that planning, whether it's 1, 2 years, or 5 years down the road. We call it priming the pump. We've talked to you about other bills in this pollution control tax credits, which we also believe are very important. But 3183, we think moves in the direction that will allow the Metals Industry Council to look forward and to look at investing in Oregon. There's been much discussion about this bill bringing in industry into Oregon. We think that it will do that. But I want to focus on keeping Oregon businesses that we have here. There's been some discussion about whether we're a tax-friendly state. I don't believe we're a tax-friendly state, too, and I don't divide corporations from individuals. I put all of that together, and I don't think we're a tax-friendly state. More importantly, overall, and you've heard a lot of this in the Tri-County area and throughout the state, we're not a business-friendly state. Our metal industry members feel very, very strongly as they look forward, and they have options between either expanding a plant or starting a new facility as to whether that's done in Oregon or it's done someplace else in other states that they already operate. And I can tell you that there has been a lot of angst in the last year for what many of our metals members believe is a very unfriendly atmosphere, not just on the tax level but on the business area. So we look forward to finishing the job that we started last session and moving to 100%. We think it makes sense from inviting industry into the state. We think it makes a lot of sense for Oregon businesses here, for their expansion, and for their business formation. Thank you very much.
Mark, so how do you respond to, I read that Utah study not too long ago, and it seems to indicate pretty clearly that in terms of just tax policy and certainly exempting out land use and anything else that you might look at, but just looking at tax policy, and say we enacted this, I guess my question would be, what would make us a tax-unfriendly state to business?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree that and you've heard it from business witnesses in this room throughout session, that the taxes by themselves do not drive final decisions. I think they are a factor in those final decisions. Quite honestly, I think CEOs make decisions just like you and I make decisions based upon what it's going to cost, not just the company, but what it's going to cost themselves personally. And that's why I think tax structure in this state is also about the personal income tax, which is one of the highest in the country. And I think that does motivate. Does it show up in a survey research? No. But I think it is a factor. And you've mentioned others, land use and the planning process, the building permits, those kinds of things. But I think it's all together. It's not one silver bullet. But as previous witnesses have said, this will, I believe, attract people to come to Oregon and distinguish, at least today, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next September, when I believe California may act, but it will distinguish Oregon from our West Coast states.
Thank you. Senator Deckert, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Craven, representing the Oregon Council of the American Electronics Association. AEA is the nation's largest trade association representing the high-tech industry. In addition to AEA's general support, a number of our member companies are also participants in the Smart Growth Coalition, Intel, Tektronix, FEI, ESI, and TriQuint are also working as part of the broader coalition. And that list does include our two oldest high-tech companies, Tektronix and ESI, and our largest high-tech company, Intel Corporation. I'm just going to hit a few points. I think it's been a good hearing. You've heard most of the arguments. Starting off with the point that if you look down at the staff measure summary, it says that this prime beneficiaries of this move would be corporations that manufacture products in Oregon and sell them to markets beyond the state's borders. I mean, I don't think anyone could say it better. And we have to continually remind ourselves that such companies are the backbone of Oregon's business community, those so-called traded sector companies that are located here, employ people here, and manufacture products and compete in global markets. I mean, there are some people who want to overlook that and think we can get by on a sort of a service-based economy or something, but those are the companies that make up the bulk of Oregon's business community. Number two, you've heard the word tools in the tool chest. Several weeks ago in the Ways and Means Subcommittee that was reviewing the Oregon Economic and Community Development Budget, the new director, Marty Brantley, in response to a question said straight to the subcommittee, "I have very few tools. I have very few tools in order to promote Oregon when I'm out drumming up business and on the road encouraging companies to come to Oregon." This is a tool in a tool chest. If not definitive, it is an important one. Third point that, we talk about that there's a cost, and there is by phasing it in, there's a delayed cost, but there is a cost in outlying by INEA. I'm not sure what the Economic Development Department budget is these days, but at one point when I was following it, they spent about $100 million of lottery dollars every 2 years trying to develop and promote economic development in Oregon. This is a more like a $10 million 4 years from now impact, and you've heard some of the biggest, strongest, most committed companies to Oregon saying, you bet, this is an economic development bill. So yeah, it does sometimes take money to generate money, and there is a cost down the road. We think it's offset eventually by added benefits, but you look at the money we spend on economic development explicitly, this would be a small fraction, and we think perhaps having equal benefits. You've also heard the phrases about sending strong messages, and you can go back in history and look at things we've done. The special session to repeal the unitary tax that was referred to earlier, the passage of the 50% weighted sales factor back in 1989, the passage of the strategic investment program a couple years later. In none of those cases do I think anyone could have given you data that would have proved in advance what would happen. In each case, people took somewhat of a risk. Governor Atiyah said, the president of Sony has said, you repeal unitary tax and Japanese companies will come invest in Oregon. There was no proof, there was no contract, but the legislature did it, and it happened. When we did 50% weighted sales in 89, you heard from Al Logan from Nike, what happened in Oregon after that? Just because of that? No, no one's arguing just because of that. But it did follow, and certainly we're all familiar with what happened when the legislature took a big risk in passing the strategic investment program. Intel said, you do that, and you're going to see something that you're going to be very proud of in Oregon. And this legislature took a risk, and it happened. So, you know, the idea of having perfect data ahead of time is probably never possible, but if we look back in history at some of the things that this body has done in tax policy, because people said, you do this, there'll be benefits. It's hard to find ones where, you know, they were total failures. And in many cases, you have something very proud to be proud of and taking somewhat of a risk. In this case, we think a very small risk to reap benefits. Finally, I do want to just close with the idea that one can have two ideas in our minds at the same time. We've gotten very binary this session. That everything's black and white. We either do this or we do that. This bill will neither add to nor detract from the very legitimate school funding crisis we face for the 03-05 budget. This bill does not have a revenue impact in 03-05. Perhaps some small impact in 05-07, but if you walk away from this bill, you have not done anything for or against the big thing that's staring in your face as far as addressing school funding for 03-05. This bill will not take away from that challenge and won't add a whole lot to it. So, I mean, saying that we have to think only about school funding, so we can't think about this, I think is a false choice of having to, you know, pick one or the other. And finally, just a technical correction. It was alleged earlier that the local mom-and-pop companies in Oregon would pay more taxes as a result of the passage of this bill. As far as I know, I think that's patently false. This bill only affects companies that have multi-state corporate filings. If you're a small business in Oregon doing your business down on the corner and filing an Oregon corporate return, this bill is not even in your universe. This bill doesn't affect you one way or the other. This only affects companies, and I would give deference to Longview Fibers and its issue. I hate to only see Kurt over the last 15 years on this subject, but companies who have significant sales into Oregon can be impacted by this change, but not a mom-and-pop company in Oregon. It totally is no impact, unless I've got that totally wrong. I'd be willing to be corrected on that. So this is not an issue about rewarding multi-state corporations and punishing local homegrown corporations. It's not the issue at all in what we're debating here. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Sorry I missed part of the testimony, but I'm curious as to your analysis as to the OTIM. I mean, the OTIM says 20 jobs. Do I believe it? Do I not believe the OTIM? What should I do with
that? Senator Deckard, Senator Ringo, I was around when we created OTIM. I'm still trying to find it in the building. I'm not sure where it's kept. I think in a dark room somewhere. That's not too... I'm just saying I have no great insight into the workings of the OTIM model. I think intuitively from the people that you've seen up here and before you today arguing that something that they have all said to you on behalf of their companies is a major and significant and positive and beneficial thing for their companies and the signals they'll send back to their corporate management and decision making to say that this has a 20-job impact just seems totally counterintuitive to me, but I'm not an expert on the workings of OTIM and don't want to challenge the model. I do challenge it from what people tell me every day about the signals we're sending, the positive benefits. So I'll let others explain OTIM for you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony. That is it. Anyone else on 3183? Great. Close the public hearing on 2183. Open a public hearing on 2372. Everyone's leaving. I have a 2:30 that I have to be to, so I'm going to pass this very shortly to the Vice Chair Ferrioli. Let's just get right into it. Larry, do you want to come up? Mr. Campbell, do you want to, are you Jim Geisinger and crew?
Do you mind if we skip the...
up to you.
Well, at least probably hear some of these guys' testimony.
I want to give an overview of the OTIF results, I guess.
Are you, Jeff? I'm going to have to depart midway through your testimony. Greetings.
Thank you. Chairman Deckert, for the record, my name is Jim Geisinger. I represent the Associated Oregon Loggers. We're a trade association representing over 1,000 family-owned contract logging companies and affiliated businesses. I'm going to introduce the substance of this bill and then turn the mics over to my colleagues, Juan Uroguin from Basco Logging in Sutherland, Oregon, and Bob Luato with Cross and Crown Incorporated in Carlton, Oregon. This Bill 2372 is a bill to strike a sunset clause that was imposed in a bill that was passed in 1999 by the legislature. The 99 bill exempted modern logging equipment from personal property taxes. It was a product of almost a decade of discussions and negotiations and compromises in this building, the final compromise which was an agreement to impose a sunset of 2008 into this bill. That was a requirement of the governor at that point to sign this bill. So, in effect, it was intended to be an eight-year experiment. I'm here to say that that experiment has been hugely successful, and I have a couple of company representatives that can testify to that effect. The bill exempted property taxes on logging equipment that was less than 8 years old. Beginning in the year 2000, the qualifying logging equipment was exempt for a minimum of 5 years. So starting next year, some of the equipment that was exempt by in the original bill will fall off of that exemption list. Our intention is to make this exemption permanent. The good news for your committee is that there is no revenue impact of this bill until 2008. There will be at least two bienniums where there will be no revenue impact from exempting modern logging equipment from personal property taxes. The benefit of this exemption, frankly, has been to help our industry through a transition of operating primarily on federal lands, harvesting large old-growth timber, to one of managing second-growth forests on private land. We all have documented, Senator Farioli certainly is familiar with the forest health crisis in this state and throughout the West. President Bush has implemented the Healthy Forest Initiative to start thinning some of our fire-prone forest, and that kind of logging operation requires a very different kind of equipment that had been traditionally used in the decades leading up to the 1999 bill. This new equipment is sophisticated, it's expensive, it's computerized, it requires huge investments on the part of our members. Now, a lot of people have asked the question, if this exemption doesn't sunset until 2008, why are we striking the exemption now? The answer to that question is very, very simple. We have to know today if we're going to make million-dollar investments in this new kind of logging equipment, what the tax consequences are going to be in the out years. By knowing today that the exemption is going to be made permanent, our members can make those difficult decisions to invest huge amounts of money to stay in business in the long term. These exemptions are not without precedent. Agricultural equipment has been exempted from personal property taxes since 1973. That farm equipment is used to harvest a crop. The logging equipment we're talking about is used to harvest a crop. We think the similarities are quite apparent. Lastly, our industry has gone through some pretty tough times, as everybody knows, yet we're still the second biggest industry in this state. We are making a huge contribution to the state's economy. Sometimes I think Oregon is the only state in the nation that talks about its second biggest industry in the past tense from time to time. We're here, we're players, and we intend on staying and contributing to the state's economy in the future. But frankly, the contract loggers of this state need this assistance to keep their equipment as modern and updated and maintained as possible so they can do the environmentally responsible work that I think the public requires. With that, I'd like to turn the mic, if I may, over to Juan Uroguin.
Chairman Deckert and members of the committee, my name is, as announced, Juan Uroguin. I'm the treasurer and owner of Basco Logging in Sutherland, Oregon. We're a small, family-owned firm that has been in the logging business for some 54 years.
My grandfather, two uncles, and father founded the company in 1949. My brothers and I are the current managers and owners of the company, having followed in our father's footsteps, and we are hopeful that we can leave this business to future generations of our family. Passage of this House Bill 2372 will be helpful in allowing us to succeed in pursuing that goal. Therefore, we appreciate this opportunity to testify before you. Like many companies in our industry, we relied heavily on federal forest land for much of our work for many years. About 85% of our jobs were on federal lands. But beginning in the late 80s with court injunctions, the listing of threatened species, political pressures to reduce logging on national forests, and the failure of the Clinton administration's Northwest Forest Plan combined to bring management activities on federal forests to an absolute standstill. Today, we work almost exclusively on private forest lands, and we've had to adapt to managing in these different kinds of forests. Second growth forests, smaller timber, new environmental restrictions have required us to invest in new and technologically sophisticated and expensive equipment. Today, we take pride in the fact that we offer a wide range of logging capabilities to the industry. Our company utilizes skyline cable systems. We can suspend logs completely off the ground to yard over streams and environmentally sensitive habitats. We have mechanized equipment that is essential in efficient second growth thinning, maximizing the recovery of fiber from the forest, and to protect our employees from injuries. This equipment is sophisticated, relies heavily on computer technology, and requires well-trained and educated operators. The significance of this history is that the legislature passed a bill in 1999 to exempt modern and environmentally sensitive logging equipment from personal property taxes. This bill was very timely, and it's been very helpful to our family to transform our company that had relied priorly on clear-cut harvesting on federal lands to one that emphasized skyline yarders, mechanized equipment, and thinning of second growth stands on private lands. Our mechanized equipment is expensive to purchase and is very expensive to maintain. The property tax exemption helped us make this transition. Making the exemption permanent will also help assure our company's future. Even with our specialized equipment, we cannot operate 12 months a year. Sometimes our equipment sits idle, and when it does, it generates no revenue. Yet, prior to 1999, this equipment was taxed on its full assessed value, regardless of how busy we could keep it. This simply is not a fair tax. The fact that we work in multiple counties with different tax rates and procedures created a bureaucratic nightmare for us as well as county assessors. Finally, we view ourselves in much the same way as family farmers. The similarity between the two industries is stark. Farming equipment has been exempt from personal property taxes since 1973, and we think our logging equipment should be as well. House Bill 2372 will remove a provision from the 1999 bill that would sunset the existing property tax exemption and make it a permanent law. Many of us are facing the reality of replacing and upgrading our equipment. It would be very helpful to know now that the exemption will continue into the future in making these investments, and I urge you to pass House Bill 2372.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Decker.
Thank you. I have to run, but I have one question that's kind of just central to this bill. I received a definition of environmentally sensitive logging equipment, and it seemed pretty inclusive. It seemed pretty broad that it would I guess, qualify most items is the sense that I got. And I guess the question is what is the justification or rationale for the state giving favorable tax treatment to those items when your company might purchase them anyhow?
Well, I would have to say that in the past dozen years, the assault that our industry has been under has been relentless and very oppressive. And when you have as many companies as we have in the logging industry that are on the margin and effectively needing a hand up, as we have been pushed down for so long, that when you are on that margin, help and assistance in any way is going to go a long ways towards maintaining the viability of our businesses that have been damaged for such a long time. Therefore, just the simple fact that it may go a long ways towards our companies and companies similar to ours just simply being able to stay in existence to make these purchases, to operate on these lands in the way that the public demands is it's essential to our survival.
Senator Deckert, having authored the bill and helped carry the bill that created this exemption, and having negotiated with the governor who signed the bill, I think I can help you with the answer to that one. Old-style systems primarily were rubber-tired skidders and tractors and towers that basically were not very capable of moving logs up to the landing without dragging them along the ground. Mm-hmm. So we took the issue and looked very hard at a public lands policy that exempts forest land from full taxation, and thought, well, it doesn't make very much sense to exempt public forest land and, or private forest land and private farmland from full property taxes and then give tax breaks to farmers but not loggers. I mean, if we're trying to keep farming and logging viable, and we have the largest public policy impact with lower taxation on farmland and farm and forest land, and we also exempt farm personal property, why in the fact weren't we exempting logging personal property? The governor, I think, succumbed to that argument, but it added a sweetener. If you have a low-pressure logging system, which uses tracks instead of tires, or tires that are so wide that they put very low pressure on the ground, you impact erosion, and you lower the compaction, the soil compaction issues. If you have an active forward or an active harvesting system that goes into the woods on a track, grasps the small diameter tree and cuts it off with an active saw, turns it sideways, delimbs it in place, drops the limbs in front of the equipment so it creates a cushion on the ground, and turns and puts that log on a forwarder, which will effectively haul it out without ever touching the ground, that is the system that prevents erosion, prevents soil compaction, really assists in operating in a much different way than we've operated in the past on that ground. So the governor was convinced that if he could incent this industry to convert to light pressure, light touch logging systems that essentially focus on smaller diameter logs, that he could assist the industry in moving out of the dependency on old growth on the federal forest lands and into a new era where it could actually help reduce fuel loads, work on the second growth and smaller diameter logs, and do so without contributing to soil erosion and soil compaction. So the parameters the governor put around this bill were that it had to be newer equipment, it had to be environmentally sensitive equipment relative to pressure weights on the ground and ability to do a lot of the operations where the logs actually don't touch the ground. And those were his parameters that we added to the bill. And I think that's why the bill got passed and that's why he signed the bill.
Did he also insist on the sunset?
The sunset was put in there, I think, just because we were in the business of looking at this thing as a trial. You know, we wanted to see whether or not it would actually incent the industry to make the change. It certainly has done that. As a matter of fact, if you wanted to log in an old-growth situation, you'd have to look hard and long to find any active logging systems now that could handle the kind of old-growth systems and old-growth logs that we had before. So the average tower when I started working with the logging industry was a 75 or 100-foot tower capable of taking logs that were 5 and 6 feet in diameter on the butt. Today, we don't even harvest anything on federal land larger than 21 inches. You know, there's an absolute diameter limitation. And most of what we do on private land is thin second growth. So, you know, there has been a big transition, and I agree with the proponents of the bill. Whatever experiment we were trying to accomplish, we have done, and if you go and survey the loggers that are in the systems today, they've had to move toward much more highly efficient and much more energy-intensive and much more systems-intensive management, and most of the equipment meets the definition of environmentally sensitive. As a matter of fact, Mr. Chairman, if you want to buy logging equipment of the old style, you can do so for 10 cents on the dollar, all you want.
Mm-hmm. Five.
Is that a nickel now?
Yeah.
Want to go with the logging, Mr. Chairman? Yeah.
For instance, our company alone, the last 3 or 4 years, has had to invest about $1.5 million to $2 million bucks just to harvest the smaller timber. So that's where the benefit
of this has come. And like Juan said, we're right at the edge right now where there's not much room. Hopefully it'll change, but that's yet to be seen. So.
I'm 15 minutes late.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I did want to help you and get the question answered. Any further questions? Mr. Luata, did you want to take a whack at the end?
Yeah, I can read my testimony in, and you
sure.
guys can...
I'll be in.
Thank you. Yeah. Please do so.
Okay. Mr. Vice Chairman. Mr. Chairman, very early.
Temporarily.
Temporary chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Luata, and I'm president of Cross & Crown, Inc., located in Carlton, Oregon. We are a third-generation logging company, and my son currently plans to carry on the tradition into a fourth generation, provided there is an economic opportunity to do so and be successful in our industry. And it is in this regard that I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2372. I testified on the bill in 95 and was eventually passed in 1999 to exempt modern logging equipment from personal property taxes. Included in the 1999 bill was the provision to terminate the exemption of at the end of tax year 2007. The intent was to implement the exemption on a trial basis. I am back here today to tell you that it has been an outstanding success and has produced the intended results. House Bill 2372 will strike the termination provision in the 1999 law and make the exemption permanent. I urge you to pass it out of this committee. Our story is a familiar one. It is not too long ago that our company did 95% of its work on public forest lands. Today, of course, we do about 95% of our work on private lands. Nearly all of our jobs involve second growth forests with a significant amount of commercial thinning on small diameter timber. If we are lucky enough to have access to federal timber sales in the future, it is almost certain that most of these opportunities will be in thinning, overstocked tree plantations that were planted over the last several decades. This type of logging requires modern, sophisticated, and expensive equipment in order to perform in the environmentally responsible manner. In 1999, the property tax exemption has helped me acquire and maintain equipment necessary to do this work. Our industry is very competitive. Margins are razor thin, and the successful loggers are those that can take advantage of every cost control opportunity that's available. I can testify that the current exemption has helped our company remain competitive and obtain the modern equipment that we need, and also has allowed us to provide benefits for our employees and contribute to our community's economy. I also think it's a significant that the Oregon Department of Forestry has testified in favor of the House Bill 2372, as environmental restrictions for protecting water, wildlife habitat, and other resources have increased dramatically, so has the need for the type of modern, technologically advanced logging equipment that is on this exemption. This exemption will affect. The department recognizes the value of this equipment for protecting the environment. Some ask, why eliminate the sunset clause now when the exemption doesn't expire until 2008? The answer is simple. By passing House Bill 2372 now, our industry will be better able to plan for the future. You can provide us the certainty we need to make the needed investments and improvements in our equipment. By making the property tax exemption permanent today, you will send a signal to our industry that you value our contribution to the state's economy and that you would like to help us succeed in the future. Please consider passing this House bill out of your committee, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lotto. I appreciate it very much. I have no further questions for this panel, but I thank you for your testimony.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Craig Hanneman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. I'm Craig Hanneman with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Our association has 50 members, and we own and sustainably manage over 5 million acres of timberland in Oregon. We're here in support of 2372, even though I guess we'd characterize it as a half a loaf. In a minute I'll explain, but in 1993, 10 years ago, the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 2438, and that bill clearly established, and I quote, that timber on private lands managed on a sustainable yield basis should be treated as a crop and not taxed as real property. That landmark legislation marked the beginning of the end of taxing trees in Oregon and treating it like every other crop, be it cabbage, cherries, or Christmas trees, regardless of the growing cycle. For 30 years, as Mr. Geisinger just noted in his previous testimony, all ag equipment used to harvest crops on ag land has been exempt from the personal property tax. And that's why we think this bill, that only exempts a portion of the logging equipment, but not all, really makes this bill somewhat of a half a loaf. So here, 10 years later, after that landmark legislation passed, we think it's time to put in sync the equipment that harvests trees in sync with agricultural equipment that's been exempt for 30 years. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Well, my mother said there was no pancake, but then it didn't have two sides. So let's bring up Mr. Riddell, Hasina Squires, and Michelle Deister from various and sundry associations and districts. We treat no witnesses in this committee as hostile witnesses.
Well, we will build a record, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties, accompanied by Cena Squires from the Special Districts Association and Michelle Deister from Biggest Cities. Let me give you some different thoughts, a different look at this. This bill, of course, would remove sunset date from a new program with a property tax expenditure. And this would be the first discussion since proponents found a way to avoid the House Revenue Committee, the first discussion, informed discussion on the value and purpose of the sunset clause. The series of statutes were adopted in 1999, and you'll see them in the lavender page that's attached to my testimony. Contains the sunset clause of July 1, 2008. The purposes of the statutes are declared to be to facilitate by means of a property tax exemption the transition to newer logging equipment that is designed and manufactured to be environmentally sensitive as current technology can provide. Sunset date is a common and valuable tool. The purpose of the sunset date is to permit the legislature to determine whether the intention of the statute has been met. With the burden on the proponents of the tax expenditure, the sunset clause gives the legislature a tool for accountability. Without the sunset clause, it is more likely that an expenditure would fade into the woodwork and become, in effect, an entitlement. Sunset clause is commonly used. You'll notice, Mr. Chair, the bottom paragraph on the first page lists just a few examples. If a property tax expenditure is working, we wonder why a sunset clause should be feared. The principal tool to determine whether a tax expenditure is fulfilling its purpose is the tax expenditure report published biennially by DAS and DOR. The most recent tax expenditure report for the coming biennium states the effectiveness of this exemption has not been evaluated because it is relatively new and potential benefits to fish habitat have not been assessed comprehensively, and I show that on the gray attachment to my testimony. Defeat this bill and proponents lose nothing. There are two full legislative sessions following this to evaluate if the tax expenditure is effective and has met its purpose, stated legislative purpose. And the statutes contain a protection for those who make these major investments in new equipment. Statute provides that if purchase is made that qualifies for the exemption by July 1, 2006, there will be at least 5 years tax-free. The DOR personal property valuation tables indicate that after 5 years, the value of this property, the assessed value, would be 46% of the original value. So there's already significant and very tangible property tax benefit locked in through the next legislative session. And finally, the revenue implications. We note that the revenue impact worsens for schools and local governments to $5.4 million in the 07-09 biennium. It's not the time now to make permanent and untested and unconfirmed state policy that has a property tax expenditure. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, I think I'll save my questions for the end because I'll ask them of all three of you. Should we proceed?
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities, and I just wanted to just wanted to state that as a policy matter, the League of Oregon Cities supports maintaining sunset provisions of tax expenditures because that promotes evaluation of the expenditure's effectiveness, just as a general policy matter. So clearly the decision to grant this exemption has already been made, and that's not why we're here. We're just, the League specifically is talking about just, you know, here to point out that we believe the sunset should remain.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and lack of the members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires, on behalf of the Special District Association of Oregon, would just like to echo Michelle's comment with respect to the policy matter of eliminating the sunset. We think sunsets provide the legislature and other interested parties with an essential tool to be able to evaluate whether or not the intended use of the tax exemption is meeting its goal and purpose. And with the removal of that, I understand that this bill simply just does one thing and eliminates that. We're not here to debate the merits of other issues related to the bill necessarily, but the issue, it is a significant issue to eliminate a sunset, and we would register our opposition to the legislation.
And thank you for your testimony, all three of you. I understand that as a matter of form, you've had, taken a position against extending sunsets on a variety of measures. So there's nothing out of the ordinary about this particular measure. It's just that you've been opposing sunset extensions because they, in fact, tend to lock in tax exemptions.
Mr. Chair, do you mean sunset removal?
Sunset, that's what I mean. Sunset, you've opposed extensions of sunset or removal. Just as a matter of course.
Well, Mr. Chair, some of the examples that you see on the front page were sunsets that are moved periodically, and I don't recall us interfering with that move at all. Particularly, the most recent one was the cargo containers.
So, are you suggesting that if we simply changed the sunset date, you might have less objection to this issue?
I think it's a fair statement, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I thank you. That's an important thing to be able to convey. I want to ask you a couple other questions.
Yeah.
We're certainly not suggesting that we remove the exemption for farming equipment. I mean, the analogy was drawn that there's a permanent exemption for farming equipment in statutes in Oregon. The analogy was made that this equipment is very much like farming equipment. You're certainly not suggesting that we revisit the exemption on farm equipment, are we?
Answer that, Mr. Chair. The distinction between the two is in terms of the profound difference now of the property tax system. When that expenditure, along with several others, were adopted, we had a levy-based system. Mm-hmm. What that did was not threaten the flow of revenues, but simply shift the cost to other taxpayers. Mm-hmm. What we have now is a rate-based system. And so any new expenditures cost actual dollars for essential public services that we all enjoy and need. So there's that distinction. The other distinction I would make, Mr. Chair, is since the agriculture exemption, mm-hmm. and the temporary logging exemption in 1999, the legislature has stated policy statutorily that it will help pay for any new expenditures that impose property tax expenditures and imposes on local government. So we'd like that recognized too.
So that if this, in fact, was a new expenditure, you'd expect some kind of a balancing appropriation from the legislature.
Mr. Chair,
this
we
would be, you'd consider this an unfunded mandate.
Mr. Chair, we would request one. Expect one? I don't know.
You can always ask.
Yes.
I just wanted to draw the distinction. We have farm equipment now currently permanently exempt from taxation. You're not suggesting that we revisit that issue.
Mr. Chair, that's not the issue here in the bill.
Right. I understand that.
Yes,
so I'll take that as a yes. You're not you're not suggesting that.
You can take that as a yes.
Okay. There is clearly the biggest tax expenditure limitation that we have is for farmland exemptions and forest land exemptions. And this seems to me to be a mechanism to ensure that the means of keeping forest production in place are assured. So obviously, I mean, we've got major tax deferral programs for farmland and for forest land in Oregon. And those are certainly costing local jurisdictions exponentially more in tax dollars than this proposal. Are we suggesting that maybe we need to rethink the forest deferrals or the farm deferrals as well?
Mr. Chair, let me put that into a little bit of historical context. when Measure 50 was drafted, because Measure 47 was so awkwardly written. The rates were locked in based on the value at the on the roll. You had some of that value from ag land captured by the shift that occurred in 73 and afterwards. So it's now we have a completely different system, and it has a more dramatic, immediate effect on revenues for essential public services.
I guess what I'm trying to do is connect public policy in Oregon. We have huge investment in maintaining farmland and forest land in production. And the policy, at least for farming equipment, is consistent. We're trying to maintain the means of production by exempting farm equipment. I guess I would see this as a very analogous situation. We have huge investment in forest land production, and we maintain that production by incenting timber growth and forestry by deferring taxation on that land. And that's probably one of the largest tax expenditure limitation expenditures that the state makes. It seems to me to make sense that we would also try to protect the means of forest production by incenting investment in the equipment that's needed to do forestry. And I guess I think that I'm looking for some consistency in public policy here.
Would you like a response, Mr. Chair?
No. All I want is a fair advantage in life.
Yes.
So the other thing, I guess, is that I remember a very similar debate when we had in the last legislative session under my gavel, and I'll just ask for the record. What is it that local jurisdictions pay for diesel tax, for fuel taxes? Yes?
Mr. Chair, in lack of members of the committee, under legislation passed last legislative session, Senate Bill 487 exempted all special taxing districts from diesel fuel taxes, as are counties and cities.
Cities and counties and special districts are all exempt from fuel taxes. Okay. Just wanted to refresh my memory on a deja vu memory that I was having as chair of this committee.
I'm happy to provide you with the bill number from last legislature.
Do you remember?
Senate Bill 487.
Sponsored by?
Yourself.
I remember. Thank you very much. I think this hearing is closed. And I believe that covers...